Welcome everyone. Thank you for being here. It's actually wonderful to see the different lights in your rooms. It's kind of early morning lights, midday lights, and early evening lights here in Europe. Just those different textures. Let's start with our 10 minutes of sitting. Other people can join us while we're sitting. Thank you, Maria. say the verse of the robe with me. Vast is the robe of liberation, a formless field of benefaction, wearing the universal teaching, and realize the one true nature, thus harmonizing all being. Vast is the robe of liberation, a formless field of benefaction, wearing the universal teaching, I realize the one true nature, thus harmonizing all being. Vast is the robe of liberation, a formless field of benefaction, wearing the universal teaching, I realize the one true nature, thus harmonizing all being. Thank you again for being here. Welcome those people who came during our sitting. It's great to see you. I'm interested today in how we can find some freedom, some ease within this life, within this self-centered dream. This weekend, Trudy and I spent a spacious weekend in the English Lake District. Imagine the deep lakes and the hills and the valleys, so green from the recent rains. I think it was Mel Weitzman who said that when the house is quiet, you hear the hum of the refrigerator. It can be heard and felt in Zazen, that subtle and not so subtle experience of what it is to live in the self-centered dream. And I wondered if when you were sitting, or if we pause just for a moment now, you can hear it, the inner fridge, the inner refrigerator. Can you feel it? I think to some extent we all have one. So, I'm in the Lake District and I can hear my refrigerator. It's making the distinctive noise it makes when I have something coming up to which I attribute importance, in this case, inquiry on Tuesday. And I start to repeat a pattern of something I have to do to myself to make that important thing happen. And I notice a kind of tightness that happens because I know something is coming towards me. It's a familiar, familiar pattern. I had a dream whilst I was in the Lake District, and a student had been asked to do a talk. And they couldn't think of anything to talk about. And so I said, talk about something that is so close to your heart you can't see it. And I think this experience of being in the Lake District, the feeling of the quiet and the spaciousness, opened up something that happens to me, a pattern that's so close to my heart, sometimes I don't notice it. And Flint, in a recent talk, talked about teachers, visiting teachers, having contact with teachers. And last night I had a dream about Flint, and I think he was admonishing me. And when I woke up, I thought, I'll remember that. And I've forgotten what he said. So I've had two kind of significant dreams recently about being a teacher and having a teacher. Last week, Trudy explored our relationship with time, how we inhabit time, and how time inhabits us. Perhaps it goes beyond any language we can employ to describe it, which is why Dogen's Uji is so beautifully expansive. I wonder how you relate to time, given that you are time, I am time, and how your individual I relates to the difficulties of being in time. Judy also shared how Suzuki Roshi once said, "I rest in every moment. I rest in every moment." And I'm very drawn to that possibility, that statement. But I think I inherited a complicated relationship with rest and activity from my father, Samuel. His father died when he was 3, and as the eldest son, he took on responsibility for his mother and his 3 siblings. He was a wing commander during the Second World War. Duty was important to him. Work was very important to him. He was very driven, and he was either working hard or completely asleep. And his ancient tangled karma led him to have this dreamy boy. You can probably imagine how it would have been. One time my mother arranged me to stay with an aunt when my father was working on the house. I have so much gratitude and love for him and the particular karma that brought us together. So my relationship with time is to some extent affected by how he was, but also my relationship with society and the world in which I was brought up. So I privilege certain sections of time. There are times that are important, such as preparing for a talk, and are times that are not so important, when I'm doing something that I think is not so worthy of my attention, perhaps. And a lot of my practice over recent years has been to try to absorb time into one space. That's why I'm attracted to Suzuki Roshi's statement, "In calmness there should be activity, and in activity there should be calmness. In calmness there should be activity, in activity there should be calmness." So when I was in the Lake District, I asked myself the following questions. What would happen to my sense of myself this weekend if I wasn't doing inquiry on Tuesday? What happens when I know I'm doing inquiry on Tuesday? And something I notice really tightens if I'm called to do something. If I'm called to do something where there's a sense of performance, a sense of responsibility. And I'm really curious about what happens in the way I hold myself and the way I relate to those tasks. What came to me is something somewhere in the middle of doing inquiry and not doing inquiry. And I think the problem is the word doing. If I say it can be done, there's a feeling of exhalation, a relaxation, a sense that each moment is really important. So my question was, how can I be in the Lake District with a new orientation towards time? So Judy and I were driving over the hills on Saturday, and this wonderful program came on the radio. It's called Soul Music. And with each edition, there's an exploration of a particular song that has touched people's lives. And on Saturday, they were exploring Y. Van Morrison's iconic song from the 1968 album Astral Weeks, means so much to so many. And the song was called Sweet Thing. So they played Sweet Thing and some other tracks from the album. And people talked about how the song threaded through their lives and their joys and their disappointments and their tragedies. And there was a wonderful woman called Alana Joy from South Africa. And she said, "I think one of the reasons I connect with this song so strongly is because it's talking about being in the moment and finding that ability to get out of your head a little bit." And that really resonated with me. almost like a I'm in this place where I'm really exploring this thing, and here's this program. She says, "The first time I heard Sweet Thing was actually Jeff Buckley's cover version in New York in the summer of 1993. I fell in love with that version because it sounded like he didn't care if anybody was listening. He just sounded so free. He's playing sometimes the same four chords that Van Morrison is playing, and sometimes he's veering off in a completely different direction, dancing around the fretboard, playing different voicings of the chords, and it's like he's almost writing his own version of it in the moment. As if, what would it sound like if Jeff Buckley wrote this song? What I love so much about Jeff's version and Van Morrison's version is that they both sound like they're tapping into that wonderful feeling of being free while they're playing. So I'm really curious about that statement. What would be that wonderful feeling of being free while you're living? Can we create something beautiful from the life songs gifted to us? But one of the retreats in Switzerland that Flint led some years ago, I'd been for Dokusan with him, and it was the evening, so it was dark, and we were the last. I was the last person in for Dokusan, and everyone was sitting in the Zendo. So we leave the room, and he closes the door behind me, and he's walking behind me, and I can hear his footsteps so clearly on that beautiful brown polished floor at Beausite. It creaks. So you can really hear each other as you move through this beautiful hotel in the reflective wooden floor. And we pause to take off our shoes before entering the Zendo. And he says, "Take care how you place your feet in the Zendo. Take care how you place your feet in the Zendo." And I wondered whether he could see or hear the suffering in my footsteps, or hear something that was just a little bit off. And when I'm thinking back to being in the Lake District, you know, there's something happens to me when I'm going to do something. I'm just a little bit off center until I can get it done. What would it be to be in the center and doing things? Jikusho Kwongroshi explains that in Rinzai Zen, you may see your teacher up to four times a day. As you go to the interview room, the teacher might listen to your footsteps. If they hear that you're going too quickly or slowly, or I add, perhaps without attention, they'll sense that your mind is straying as you walk and ring the closing bell even before you open the door. Sorry, maybe next time. When I was 26, I read this poem. I turned to this poem the night my mother died. It's Ash Wednesday by T.S. Eliot. I've no idea why I turned to it during that long night after she'd died, but I did, and I turned to this page, and I'd only really just thought of it as a blessing from my mother, because the lines are as follows. He's talking to, he's it there it's in a way there's a Christian orientation to it, but for me he's talking to a particular female presence or energy. He says, "Blessed sister, holy mother, spirit of the fountain, spirit of the garden, suffer us not to mock ourselves with falsehood. Teach us to care and not to care. Teach us to sit still." And ever since I was 26, I've just realized that that was my first koan. Teach us to care and not to care. Teach us to sit still. Even among these rocks, our peace in His will. And I've carried that apparent polarity, caring and not caring. In relation to how I tighten up and how I prepare for something, where is the suffering? John Dado Laurie talks of a koan, which involves laywoman Pang, and their daughter Ling Chao. And the koan involves difficulty, so it goes difficult, 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 easy, 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 neither easy nor difficult. And he offers a commentary on the koan. Is life easy? Is life difficult? Is it neither difficult nor easy? And what he says is the truth is that it can't be found in either of the extremes. Why? Because neither of the extremes exists. So if I paraphrase what he says about this, he says, I say it is not to care, nor not to care, nor neither to care, nor not to care. I say it is not to care, nor not to care, not neither to care, nor not to care. So from that, I take, there is no caring and not caring. How would that be? It doesn't exist. And at the same time, there is. So the koan that I was offered by my mother in that poem is moving forward. There is no caring and not caring. And at the same time, there is. I was really thinking about the mystery we are to each other, the mystery we are to ourselves. And I love the book To the Lighthouse by Virginia Woolf. This little passage is about Mr. Ramsay, who is a mystery to everybody in the family. And they're going to visit this lighthouse. They've planned and planned, and they're just going to visit this lighthouse. And I'm going to read you a little passage, because I think it, for me, points out something about the beautiful mystery we all are. Mr. Ramsay buttoned his coat and turned up his trousers. He took the large, badly packed brown paper parcel, which Nancy had got ready, and sat with it on his knee. Thus, in complete readiness to land, he sat, looking back at the island. With his long-sighted eyes, perhaps he could see the dwindled, leaf-like shape standing on end, like a plate of gold, quite clearly. What could he see? Cam wondered. It was all a blur to her. What was he thinking now? She wondered. What was it he sought so fixedly, so intently, so silently? They watched him, both of them, sitting bareheaded with his parcel on his knee, staring and staring at the frail blue shape, which seemed like the vapour of something that had burnt itself away. What do you want? They both wanted to ask. They both wanted to say, ask us anything, and we will give it you. But he did not ask them anything. He sat and looked at the island, and he might be thinking, we perished, each alone. Or he might be thinking, I have reached it, I have found it. But he said nothing. Another beautiful polarity. I'm going to conclude with a poem I've recently revisited, which I love, and I want to include it in the talk. But it's apposite for this because it refers to ease and allowing ourselves to enjoy this life exactly where we are. It's called The Little Duck. Some of you know it. The Little Duck. Now we are ready to look at something pretty special. It is a duck riding in the ocean, 100 feet beyond the surf. She can rest while the Atlantic heaves, because she rests in the Atlantic. Probably she doesn't know how large the ocean is, and neither do you. And what does she do, I ask you? She sits down in it. She reposes in the immediate, as it were infinity, which it is. She has made herself a part of the boundless by easing herself into it just where it touches her. May you ease yourself into the boundless just where it touches you. Thank you. So if any of those thoughts that I've put together prompt some inquiries, some questions that we can explore together, please do come and join me. No, Michael?
Gosh, I have no idea who you are.
Nor do I.
That makes two of us. So what the things you were talking about made me think about is that not that long ago, I wrote sort of a little couple of stream of consciousness things. And then I found a notebook that I had written probably over 50 years ago, maybe 57 years ago. And I read what I had written, and I saw that the two things were remarkably similar. And they were both curious and unhappy about current circumstances. And just waiting for the right answer to appear and to occur. And I've spent most of my life what I would call waiting. And I occupied my waiting by making lists of things to do. And I know that since I started meditating and looking into this, I realized how much pleasure I get out of crossing off an item on my to-do list. There's a real endorphin rush as I cross it off. And when I get to the end of my list, what do I do now? I know that I was recently, over the past week, at a I guess an integrated intensive is what Flint and Peg called it. They were in person here in Austin, Texas at Appomattox. And I had such a glimpse of what if I could feel, or what if I could notice that everything was okay right now as it was. That yes, there are things I have to get done, and yes, things that I have done, but maybe it's okay now.
Yeah.
And I think that's a lot of what you were talking about. Mm-hmm. And so I
really resonate with with what you're saying. The kind of almost the opening of feeling that who I am now and how I do things now is okay. It's all right. There's some kindness in saying this is me. This is how it is. And sometimes, you know, there's a little opportunity for an opening like there was for me this weekend, where it was more physical, almost like I could breathe out. I could enjoy the possibility of something a little bit different in the messiness of
So near the end of the retreat, we were doing a kinhen. And my mind was particularly active, just bouncing all around with all kinds of things. And it occurred to me that this was the way I am. And that this was, it was not going to be that it was going to end and I would find sort of a quiet place forever. But that it was important for me to find my place in the midst of, as you put it, the hum of the refrigerator. And for me, I'm listening to the tinkle of the fountain of my kitty's water fountain. So,
I mean, there are a lot of refrigerators in this room at the moment, aren't there? We all have our different refrigerator sounds and challenges, and part of being together is we support each other to take care of those. It's the self, I guess it's the self-centered dream. But what you were talking about was being just this moment, compassion's way. Beautiful sharing of that, that I am just this moment. I'm this person who is like this. It's maybe that's kind of the essential kindness that we can offer ourselves.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We have Lynn.
Lynn.
Hi.
Hi.
Isn't that Japanese for yes?
Yes.
As I was listening to you, Josh, I'm sitting by a window and the breeze is just moving the silver birch trees, and I don't know if something just felt like that as I was listening to you talking. And one of the things that's kind of been happening for me over this over the weekend, it seems that the weekend is obviously an important time for us, is something to do with the part of me that loves to play, and how the there's also a part that says that's not okay. And I have my small granddaughter who is 4 with me this weekend, and one of the things that she taught me, which I love, is that once we see something as an object, it's lost all its possibilities. And somehow that feels to fit for me with the part that wants to play. That's somehow that's a sort of creative, I don't know how you describe it really. It doesn't want to name things or pin them down or put them in boxes. And I love that four-year-old is teaching me again and again, to trust the play. I don't know how to put it.
Feels like you're really being creative in finding what's actually finding, things that kind of are there, a young child, to to support just being you.
And that the possibility of anything being anything, really, because as soon, you know, and it feels the kind of, I suppose there was a similarity for me with what you were talking about how once you start to focus on something, you had the talk in your mind, and once you, something tensed or narrowed, or I don't know the words, what you use, tensed, I think. And I recognize that happens for me too. Like if I try to define something too much, then somehow I lose the all of the possibilities.
I think, you know, one of the gifts of this weekend is that, you know, when we create retreats or I'm creating a talk, I'm looking to offer something beautiful, you know. And sometimes I can get a little tight around a task. It's like, oh, you just offer something beautiful, something powerful, or whatever. You know, it's and what I hear, you know, I think I'm really curious about how we teach ourselves when we've been practicing for some time. You know, we have help from inside to talk to us, find words, perspectives. Yeah.
Help from each other, and help from everything. But there's something about staying open. I suppose that's the thing, isn't it? Staying open to
and kind of knowing that you have that kind of slight tension around, you know, around playfulness, and being with that and taking care of that.
It's always going to be there. So.
There was the teacher, I think he's called Seng San, he's a Korean teacher, and a student came up to him and said, you know, people think I'm crazy doing this practice. And he said, you're not crazy enough.
And I've always loved the story about Suzuki Roshi. When I can't remember whether it was at Tassajara or somewhere, where somebody came up to him and they were meant to be silent. And Suzuki Roshi spoke to whoever it was, and the student said, "I'm supposed to be silent." And Suzuki Roshi turned around to everybody and went, "Shh." So, yes.
Yeah.
Let's keep playing.
Keep playing.
And be serious too. Thank you. Thank you, everybody. Good to see everyone.
And we have Becky.
Hello, Becky.
Hello. Oh.
Hello.
Yes, hello. Time itself is a self-centered dream, or a shared one in some ways, because it's a construct, a human construct. And so, yeah, it's sort of one of those basic ones that when we cling to time, that it's because we are not in the moment. Something like that. A moment isn't a time thing. It just is.
Yeah.
Whereas a minute is a time thing.
Aha. Uh-huh. Yeah. It's a measurement, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a measurement. It's a construction that we have that comes in handy if we ever want to see each other. No. Because if we didn't have some common way to get together, it comes in handy, but we live too much by it in this world and miss a lot of moments, I think. And I really love what Lynn was saying about words in relationship. Like one of the hardest times that I had about language, because I love language. I play, it's one of my favorite toys, you know? And so when my first baby was born, I really had an extremely difficult time to start teaching her, like encouraging her to talk, because I really felt that like once I've done that, I've put parameters around things for her to know what's going on. It's something that does, and I really angst over it, like hugely. And then somebody gave us a book that was called A Flower Pot Is Not a Hat, But If You Put It on Your Head, It Is. And that helped me a whole lot to see that it doesn't have to be limited just because we made a word out of it and there, you know, all of that stuff. It doesn't make it all a thing if we can keep it not in our thinking and being with. So.
Yeah, I'm thinking about the schedule for a retreat. You know, it's a very organized schedule. Everything happens at a certain time. And paradoxically, it's designed, one of the design features of it is to see into the depths of your life. It's a paradox, isn't there? We organize really carefully for a retreat, and yet, it's both, perhaps.
Yeah. Well, actually, if things don't bump into each other, we don't really get it. In some ways, we need those paradoxes. We need those times when you have a specific time factor going on for the depths, right? Is that it makes us aware of the depth and aware of our own intention to mold things into something. But it's when they bump.
I mean, I know Flint said Zen is being on time. so there's a, you know, there's a spaciousness, and then there's Zen is being on time. And that's a curious paradox to work with, I think.
Indeed. Yeah. Thanks for this stretch.
Thank you.
We have Kathy.
Well, thank you, Josh. I wanted to raise my hand for a couple reasons. One was just to thank you for this beautiful talk. And then you said you were thinking that what you wanted to do was offer something beautiful. And my goodness, you have, between the poetry and the music and the stories and the depth. So that was one of the reasons I wanted to raise my hand. And the other one was because, I don't know if you remember, but I think it must have been 2020. You and I talked in one of the retreats about time and schedule.
Yeah.
And it really helped me to realize that, I always run late. I run late. And I realized recently that, well, of course I do. I come by it honestly. I come from a family that ran late, you know. I had six siblings and a busy house, and my mother had what she could do to keep up and do the things that needed to be done on time. So that helped me to realize that, you know, this is kind of this is something that's in my bones in a way. And it helped me to distinguish time and schedule, because I figured, well, you know, schedule is something I can do something about. I can make choices about that. I can't say I've done much better. And recently, I realized that I'm often kind of a little off in terms of focus, because I'm either zigzagging, you know, between things. So I might not get to what I was intending to do quite when I meant to. And, or else I'm kind of like ultra focused and not focusing on anything else but one thing, which might take me away from some of the things that I maybe should be doing. So, you know, it gets back to time and schedule. And your quote about calmness in activity and activity in calmness, I think really offers me something to work with that.
Great.
And so I'm really grateful for that.
I love that we share a kind of, we're both drawn to that.
Yeah, it's incredible, actually. And I was also thinking about the four-year-old, and I volunteer with four-year-olds. I play with kids once a week, and I realized I'm always focused when I'm with them. You know, there's something about their energy and my energy, and actually needing to be totally present so that I know how to respond. That provides that a kind of focus, and I want to kind of keep that as a question about, you know, I don't want to try to answer it, but just note it and see how I might bring that into my daily life.
I mean, I'm really, really appreciating your questions and your kind of rich mix of time wonderings.
Right. Well, thank you. The other thing I would add to it is that in all of this, through your talk, I've realized I've been taking myself much too seriously. So thank you for that as well.
So good to see you. Thank you, Kath.
Thank you.
We have Shannon next.
Hi, Shannon.
How are you? As everyone has been talking, I've been kind of, so in my life right now, I'm in the midst of planning a wedding, and which is taking place in a couple of weeks. And in my daily life, I work with a bunch of designers, and I think constantly about how much effort is involved in creating ease, a sense of ease. it's when something feels easy, there is a mountain, an iceberg of wading through chaos and struggle to make that appear as it does. And I wonder, you said to create something beautiful, you know, and I wonder if the process of sort of like wading through that chaos and sort of the heart amped up and kind of the mental, you know, ramping up is in service of that ease for other people in many cases. Is the chaos and the trip through the chaos to the ease, just necessary and part of the gift that we're giving to others? And I wonder what you thought about that.
I wonder if, you know, the ease. First of all, the ease isn't a project, and you're not.
Yeah.
Because sometimes we don't know what it is. What is it to be at ease in a situation, in a family or a workplace? So the first question is, what would it be for me to feel some sense of spaciousness and ease while also being in this busy, crazy place? And it happens with a first step. Like, what is that? What would it be? And small steps.
Mm-hmm.
And just one person who's a little bit more spacious or at ease can help others. It's part of the Bodhisattva vow, I guess, to offer some relaxation of suffering. So I suppose, where is the suffering for you and for other people, and in what ways can you meet it? But start with you.
I mean, I think in those examples that I gave, let's see. I think that there can be space and playfulness around the chaos. It's sort of both. That I think that there is a process and ease around process. And I think that there are, and maybe I'm just bringing my work hat to Zen, but I think that there are sort of results, right? Like, the moment at the end of that road, you've come and given a talk to us, right? As a thing that exists, that brings us something.
You're saying you're bringing your work hat to Zen.
Mm-hmm.
It's your Zen hat to work.
That's one of the that's a challenge.
See what happens. Chaos is everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not like it's just how it is, and how are we going to meet it with some poise and some ease and some purpose and get things done. It's like you've got some great questions there.
Thank you, Josh.
Thank you. So I realize we're coming up to, and I can't really see on my screen if there's anybody else waiting. Is there anybody else waiting, Maria?
No, there isn't, Josh, no.
Perfect timing then. So in a moment we'll say the four practice principles with kind of the awareness, I guess, of what we've been exploring together. So we'll, if you'd accompany me in the four practice principles. Caught in the self-centered dream, only suffering. Holding to self-centered thoughts, exactly the dream. Each moment, life as it is, the only teacher. Being just this moment, compassion's way. Caught in the self-centered dream, only suffering. Holding to self-centered thoughts, exactly the dream. Each moment, life as it is, the only teacher. Being just this moment, compassion's way. Caught in the self-centered dream, only suffering. Holding to self-centered thoughts, exactly the dream. Each moment, life as it is, the only teacher. Being just this moment, compassion's way. Thank you, everybody, for being here this evening. And thank you, Maria, for making it possible. So I'll hand over to you. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Josh. And I can really relate to that tightness when before preparing for something. And thank you for the reminder to turn towards it and quieten that extra noise so that I can listen to the hum, you know, the inner refrigerator, as you call it. So thank you so much for that reminder, and thank you all for being here and making it possible. You know, it doesn't happen without you all turning up and holding the space. So thank you all so much. And if you'd like to offer Dana to Josh, then please do go to justthiszen.org/giving, and you'll find a place to offer Dana there. I'll stick it in the chat. That's a bit Barovian. But if you'd like to continue for a further 30 minutes, then please do pop yourself into gallery view, and I'll be with you in just a moment. But thank you all so much for being here. Thank you.